It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we find out how the U.S. could transition to an all-electric, all-renewable energy system by 2050.
But first, a new bill is moving quickly through the Wisconsin legislature that would allow communities to sell their water utilities to private out-of-state companies. Critics are concerned about losing public accountability for managing critical water services.
The bill's sponsors say it would help communities sell off failing systems that require costly maintenance and repairs. Steve Verberg joins us now. He's covering the story for the Wisconsin State Journal. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as I understand it, it's not completely new, this idea of privately owned municipal water systems. Superior has something like this, for example. What's different, though, in this new legislation?
The first thing that the legislation would do is that it would open up ownership opportunities for out-of-state corporations. Superior is owned by one that's in-state, and that's all the law allows at this time.
So as of now, unless this new law passed, only a Wisconsin company could do this, own water and sewer supplies, and not many seem to be doing that.
Correct. Just the one. For a while, Beloit was owned privately, but the city purchased the system back a few years ago.
And when we're talking about these municipal water systems, we're talking specifically about the water supply and then the sewer utility, and that's it. This isn't something like we've seen in the past, access to tap water for a bottling plant or something like that.
That's correct. It doesn't cover any other utility. It doesn't cover electrical utilities, for example, just water and sewer.
And so the bill's principal author has said, hey, there's at least one out-of-state company that would be interested in doing this. That's why it's needed. So what kind of case have the sponsors of this bill been making?
They just want to provide an option, is what the lead author says. At this time, there aren't any out-of-state companies that are seriously looking at coming into Wisconsin to do this, but there aren't any Wisconsin companies that are actively doing it either. So the sponsors want to just open up that opportunity.
And so there's at least one company that's saying, hey, maybe someday. Are there municipalities that have come forward and said, yes, we want this opportunity?
My understanding is that there are not.
And so what is the case for the advantage of this being an option? Why would it be helpful, according to the sponsors of the legislation, to have this option for a community to sell off the infrastructure, the water sewer utility?
Well, the sponsor says that this would provide an opportunity for a community that was facing some very expensive repairs and maintenance to get out from under that and to be able to have a private company that perhaps one that has deep pockets make those repairs. The community would also get some immediate cash benefits from selling the water and sewer system.
And as I understand it, there's another part of the legislation right now. If a town were to look at doing this, it would have to be approved by a public referendum. Under this law, that referendum would be optional. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. At this time, the Public Service Commission would set the terms of the sale, and then there's a mandatory vote by the public, and it has to be approved by the public to go through. Under this, people would need to gather petitions in order to force a referendum, and the referendum would occur before the terms of the sale were known. That's one of the criticisms of the bill.
Talking to reporter Steve Verberg from the Wisconsin State Journal about legislation currently in the state legislature that would make it possible for municipal governments, local governments, to sell their water and sewer utilities to out-of-state private companies and make it easier for that transition to happen, as we just heard, by changing the referendum laws. You mentioned briefly there, Steve, opposition to this. Water, touchy subject these days in particular. What kind of reaction has this gotten from critics?
Well, people are concerned about the accountability, the potential loss of accountability if it's a private company instead of a public utility operating a crucial system like a water system or a sewage system that disposes of sewage. So those are the main concerns there about accountability and also cost. There was one group that has lobbied against it who said made the point that this private company a private company wouldn't come in order to break even. They'd want to make a profit.
And how have sponsors respond to that kind of criticism about both cost and accountability?
Well, I think the general argument that's made is that the Public Service Commission would continue to set rates for water and sewer services, and the DNR would continue to monitor and enforce laws on water quality.
So, where is this now in this in the process in the state legislature?
There's a Senate committee that approved the bill today. Next, it goes to the Senate. The Assembly's already approved a version of the bill. If the Senate approves it, then it goes to the governor for his signature.
And is it anticipated to pass in the full Senate?
I couldn't say that for sure. I haven't heard anything from the leadership at this time, but haven't heard of any opposition within the Republican caucus either.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Steve Verberg, reporter covering politics and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about a bill that would allow communities to sell their water and sewer utilities to private out-of-state companies. Whether it's because of climate change and solutions to that crisis, global terrorism and its impact on energy supply, or environmental and public health considerations, there's been a growing interest in recent years in alternative sources of clean and renewable energy.
Our next guest has been working in the energy field for half a century. He says that the United States should be focusing on renewable electricity sources to solve our energy needs. David Freeman was one of the architects of the EPA under the Nixon administration and headed up major public utilities in Tennessee, Texas, California, and New York. His most recent book is called All Electric America, Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks to be here. And I actually work mainly for Jimmy Carter and was the architect of his policies for renewable energy and efficiency. And he's a dear friend of mine. So I have worked for presidents of both parties, but I've been advocating and implementing renewable energy for a long time. It used to be something that we thought would be a good thing to do. Now it is a necessity for life on this planet to continue as we know it. But the good news is that we've developed the solar and wind and storage technologies where over the life of the new plants, they're actually cheaper than coal and gas and oil and nuclear.
Well, let's talk about that cheaper aspect, because that's something that a lot of critics worry whether it is actually cheaper, because you have all this infrastructure already in place for fossil fuels. How can it be cheaper?
Well, because every year you got to dig up more coal and you got to pay for it. Mother Nature provides the solar and the wind free of charge. So once you make the investment in the power, it's like the what is the cheapest electricity in America today? It's the dams that we built 20, 30 years ago that are paid off and give us virtually free electricity. You've got to look at the life of the plant, the coal plants. I mean, I've run big utilities. You got to buy coal every year, and you got to buy oil, and you got to buy gas. And if we move to an all-renewable energy supply, it will be virtually inflation-proof. And over the life of the investment, it's going to be cheaper. And anybody that just thinks a little bit will understand that. The problem is we got natural gas and oil and those guys advertising all the time and buying the government with their contributions. And the people don't even know the truth. The modern-day Thomas Edisons, they learned how to harness the sun and the wind, and they learned how to store power, and it's happening in California. It's happening in Hawaii, and it can happen all over the country. 30 or 40 years ago, the electric power industry used to advertise the all-electric home. My little hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee, when I was a kid, I had to shovel coal into a furnace. We cleaned up the city with the hydropower, green power from the dams that was built under Franklin Roosevelt in the Tennessee Valley. And we have a new form of green energy that the sun and the wind that will do just as much good as the hydropower did 30, 40 years ago. We just need to go for it, and the people people need to know about it. We need to pass some laws to make the electric power industry stop building any new fossil fuel or nuclear plants. And we need to start requiring the automobile companies to make and market more and more electric cars. And we can go all electric America. It will be cleaner and it will be cheaper. But if we don't do it, we're going to cook.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that plan. Can you lay it out for us? How do you make this transition by 2050, percentage by percentage point?
3% a year. I lay it out in my book. All we have to do is to phase out the bad stuff and phase in the new stuff at 3% a year. And by 2050, we can be 100% renewable, and it will be lower in cost. But we've got to start. The problem, quite frankly, with the President of the United States and the leaders of every other country, it doesn't take a lot of courage to say in 2050 we're going to be clean, but actually do nothing really now that Mother Nature can notice. And natural gas is just as bad as coal because the methane leaks, you just don't see it. In Southern California today, there's a massive leak of methane, and that stuff is 100 times as powerful as carbon. I mean, all the fossil fuels are poison. We ought to use that word. And we need to just replace it 3% a year. We can do it. In fact, it's happening. California has moved from nothing to 30% renewable, but we've got to not only make all the electricity renewable, we've got to use the electricity to replace oil and gas. The technology is there. I never dreamed I'd live long enough to see General Motors advertising electric cars. That was in the movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? But now they're selling them. And all we need to do is to make them sell more and more of them and provide incentives for people. For example, if the utility in your state would own the battery, it could be part of their storage system. It would dramatically reduce the cost of electric cars, and people would start buying them like hotcakes.
We're talking to David Freeman right now. He's the author of the new book. It's called All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. He's calling for the U.S. to move to a transition to all renewable electric energy by the year 2050. And, David, let's talk about that year, 2050. What happens in 2050? Why then?
Well, then we will have a completely sustainable energy supply, and we'll live happily ever after. I mean, we'll leave something for our grandchildren that is really important, a perpetual, sustainable energy supply. And we can have the kind of better life that we talk about. They call it the American dream, remember?
And you say we can get there.
But if we don't do that, the family doctor, the climatologist, is telling us that you won't be able to have a happy life even in Wisconsin. Either you believe the family doctor, if your kids and the doctor said they're on a diet that's going to kill them in 35 years, and all you have to do is switch to something that doesn't cost any more, 3% a year, everybody would do it. We just have to start really acting on what the climatologists are saying and passing some laws to make it happen. That's what we did with seat belts. That's what we did when we had lead in toys. That's what we do when we have something poisonous. But the politicians need to stand up and look the oil and gas people in the eye and tell them to go to hell.
And is that going to happen in the foreseeable future? Are you talking about a rewrite of the American political system?
If you feel the burn, maybe it will.
Well, there is some leadership, President. There was a big climate agreement just recently. Are you happy with the progress that's being made? You're calling for something.
Yeah, but the climate agreement is not an agreement. The climate agreement is not an agreement. They haven't agreed to do anything. These are just goals. The problem is the United States of America made them change it from shall to should because the American Congress right now wouldn't approve it. And so the whole thing in Paris is what should be done. But in order to make it happen, you got to pass some laws this year and next year. And we at least ought to be fighting for what needs to be done so the young people will know what to fight for. Right now, nobody is really talking like I am. And they need to because we've gone along now you know, Al Gore raised these issues almost 10 years ago. We've done nothing but talk up to now. Mother Nature hasn't noticed the difference. But the greenhouse gases keep going up. They're not going down. They're going up.
I want to talk about the clean sources of energy that are part of your plan. You can think of solar and wind. And in general, people worry that those are not
storage.
Those are not.
Yeah, but
those are not base load.
Combine it with storage. You know, just read the Bible. The Lord said when you have a good year, you put some in storage so you have something in a bad year. We have technology now that can store electricity. Mm-hmm. When we have it and use it when the sun's not shining. So that argument no longer holds water. I mean, I've run the power systems. We know how to store electricity, and the cost has come way down.
So David,
do we have the
technology that we need already for the storage that you're outlining right now for technologies like solar and wind?
Yes. You ever heard of something called a battery? The batteries are just better and better than ever. We know how to do pump storage. I've had those projects on my system. You pump the water up at night, and then you run it through the turbine the next afternoon, and you can store it that way. But there's compressed air. All you got to do is to Google the word storage and look on the dictionary. It's all there, and it's being implemented. Like I tell you, in California, the Southern California Edison Company has just bought 250 megawatts of storage, and they're not a charity. They're a private company doing what their public service commission is urging them to do. The technology is there. We just haven't given the utility industry the right marching orders yet, and that's what needs to be done.
In Wisconsin, we're having a debate right now about nuclear power. Is that a part of your clean energy future?
No, nuclear power is not clean. It's very, very dangerous, and it's very, very expensive. Solar and wind are now cheaper than nuclear power. There is no utility that has to compete with building a nuclear power plant anywhere in America. And the old plants are piling up that fuel trash, nuclear waste, that we haven't figured out what to do with it in 50 years. So we had the nuclear dream. It just failed. And I've run utilities and nuclear power plants that I had to shut down because they just cost too damn much, and we haven't figured out what to do with the nuclear waste. But we don't need nuclear power. We have solar and wind, which are the most abundant sources of energy on Earth, and we know how to harness it. We just need to implement it like we're doing. I mean, California just passed a law that they have to go to 50% renewable by 2030. We need those kind of laws in every state, and then we need to order the utilities to start marketing their electricity in place of oil and gas. We need to electrify the railroads. We need to do a lot of things that will create millions of jobs and actually reduce costs, because electric motors are very efficient. They're 98% efficient, more efficient than the internal combustion engine. And, you know, this country is capable of doing things. We just need to give the right message to the younger people. This is their issue. This is going to ruin their lives if we don't do something about it and start doing something real. And we've got to put the oil and gas people out of business over the next 35 years, 1 year at a time. And because we've invented a better mousetrap, the solar and wind and storage combined is just cheaper and cleaner and more abundant than anything else we have. And we're not going to eliminate nuclear proliferation threats if we keep building more and more nuclear power plants, and we don't know what to do with the nuclear trash. And anybody that knows anything about the subject is well aware that that's one of the biggest threats we face.
Now, we're in the midst of a run-up to a presidential election. What would you like to see the candidates talking about, and in what direction would you have them move in?
Well, I have them move along the lines that I'm saying, that it's no longer a question of whether we should move to a 100% all-renewable energy supply. We must, and I'd like to see them debate on exactly how to go about doing it. Instead, we're getting nothing out of the Republican side and nothing but platitudes out of the Democrats. And the so-called environmental movement ain't moving. They're silent. So I'm trying to raise my voice to see if we can at least give these young people. I was in a parade with them in New York City about 9 months ago, and they talk about environmental justice, but nobody is giving them a platform of real action to fight for. My book does it. It can be obtained by Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And I just hope people will read it and, engage in the debate.
David, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure, as you can see. Thank you so much for having me.
David Freeman is the author of the new book, All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. He's calling for the U.S. to move toward a transition to all renewable electric energy by the year 2050. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Small town and rural communities are a big part of Wisconsin, culturally and geographically. And in those communities, the local school district can play a big role in educating the students, of course, but also as a public meeting space and a focus of civic pride.
But those school districts face a unique set of challenges, declining enrollment and difficult budget situations, leading to tough decisions about where to spend, where to cut, and even whether to merge districts.
Our next guest examines the perfect storm facing rural schools in Wisconsin. Sarah Kemp is a researcher at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory, where she focuses on Wisconsin school districts. She's also a school board member for the Lakeland Union High School. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with enrollment. What have we been seeing in school enrollment in these small town and rural districts around the state in recent years?
In recent years, we have definitely been seeing a decline in enrollment, and my research looked at both what we describe as town districts versus rural districts, but the town districts being a little bit closer to urban centers, but the more rural districts have definitely seen a dramatic decline. And they have seen close to 73% of these districts over the last 5 years have seen decreases in their enrollment.
And you project in a chart out of your recent research that trend is expected to continue for the next few years, right?
Yes. For the foreseeable future, I'm projecting that we will continue to see that decline. A large part of that is due to declining births in the state of Wisconsin, and especially in the rural areas of Wisconsin. And so we are likely to continue to see decline.
And other reasons, aging population in these rural areas and I guess out-migration, people moving to bigger cities, is that part of it?
There are a combination of demographic shifts occurring, especially in rural Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin in particular, where there is an aging population. People who may move out young people may go off to college and may not return to their communities, as well as retirees then moving into the areas as well as a factor, as well as I mentioned, the births declining, just fewer births happening.
So talk a little bit about the impact. How does declining enrollment affect that local school?
Well, the enrollment decline really does factor in considerably to a budget for all school districts. And because the state formula for funding for budget purposes is based very strongly on enrollment, that's one of the key components that's used. And so if you have declining enrollment, you have declining funding.
And declining staff levels as well, right?
Right. So then if you have declined funding and don't have the resources to pay for your teaching staff, unfortunately, districts have to look at places where they need to cut. And when we have fixed costs like transportation and food, those are increasing over time and have to, those are costs that have to be incurred. And so then the district has to look at other ways to do that. And one of those ways might be in teacher cuts or instructional cuts.
Talking to Sarah Kemp with UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory about rural school districts and small-town districts around the state, declining enrollment we've been hearing about, and we'll get more into what that does with a tough budget situation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in one of these districts? Do you send your kids to school there? Do you work in one of these districts? What's going on where you are? What kind of choices are you having to make? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. And Sarah, on the revenue side for the school, the money coming in, you mentioned fewer students means less school aid from the state because it's partly based on how many students are going to that school. Also, there have been some general cuts overall in school funding, and these, I imagine, are not particularly wealthy districts where the local populace can be counted on. So there's not really a plan B for the funding that's lost when enrollment goes down, is there?
No, there isn't. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion over the years, and especially the last couple of years, of fixing the funding formula. Some people feel that is something we really need to address, especially for rural districts. And my research didn't specifically focus on the funding component of it. What I was more interested in looking at was how does enrollment and costs affect school districts, and that was really truly my focus. But funding definitely plays a part in the bigger picture.
And on the cost side, then, you mentioned earlier the concept of fixed costs. So I've got a school, fewer kids are coming, my building hasn't gotten any smaller, the cost to heat it haven't gotten any smaller, or to run a bus line. So just because there are fewer students, the costs don't really go down for a school.
Right, exactly. So if you have those fixed costs aren't going to change, regardless if you have 1,000 children in your building or 500 children. And transportation costs are talked about a lot because of the larger rural districts geographically. There is also that expense of transporting students from their home to school. So that definitely plays a factor. And so those are all pieces of the budget that are fixed.
Well, I wanted to
or increasing.
I wanted to get some input from our listeners around the state on this issue at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Bob now in Stevens Point. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
We've got too many school districts. We've got too many school districts where when consolidation took place, they said, well, if you keep a little school in our village, we will join X. If not, we'll join Y. But some of those school districts, if you go to some of the small villages around here, they've got everything under one plant or in proximity to each other. You cannot run small school districts. Look at the administration cost. When you talk about cost of instruction, the problem isn't the cost of instruction. It's the number of students to maintain it. State mandates language. Yes, how are you going to mandate a language? The problems go on and on. Yes, busing would be up, but there are ways some of that would be overcompensated by the other. I'll hang on.
Bob, thanks a lot for bringing those issues up. So, Sarah, the argument that we have a lot of these school districts in small towns and rural areas, Bob saying too many. First of all, how many districts are we talking about? You kind of laid out the scope of where districts are and which category they fit into in your report.
Sure. So if we just are focusing on the rural school districts within the report, there's a total of 424 school districts in the state of Wisconsin, and 233 of them are classified as rural. So that is over half, 55% of the district. So Bob is correct in that, you know, there are many smaller rural districts, and so there is sometimes discussion about consolidating districts, and there are several around the state that are entering that discussion. But then also that sometimes alleviates the costs, but it also sometimes exasperates it with transportation costs increasing because now you're needing to bus a student even further because you've enlarged that geographic area of your rural school. So it depends on, of course, where those students live, but it's the total number is 233 districts in the rural category.
Now, this is a bit outside your research, but you do, I think, in one chart, cite an editorial that mentions this point, that school district might be the focus for the community in a lot of ways. Maybe Rotary has their pancake breakfast there. It might be the high school sports team, the football team, the basketball team might be an object of civic pride. So a community might feel like it's going to lose something if it consolidates the control of its local school district. Is that an obstacle, you think, to people actually doing that?
Sure. I mean, I think there's definitely a balance to be had because so many buildings are community buildings, especially in rural areas. And so there is a sense of pride for many individuals in their community for their schools. And so closing schools is really an emotional activity for many areas. And so that is definitely a component of it.
Bob, thanks a lot. Brought up some good points. We'll go next to Chris in Waupun. Chris, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, my comment is just my personal opinion is where I live, it's rural, and there's local schools, smaller school districts, and it seems like as the schools make cuts, these smaller schools, more and more cuts, and now they have less programs to offer, more and more kids are just taking a school choice and they're going to other schools because their school can't offer what they want, and it just kind of compounds, and it seems like these laws are putting these schools right out of business.
Chris, thanks for that call. And Sarah, if I recall correctly, this was a point for further research for the future that you're interested in, the impact of private schools, charter schools, vouchers for private schools on these smaller districts. Is that right?
Yes, so this particular research just focused on the public schools and did not take into consideration those other alternatives. That's definitely for future research. Just what I know, I think that there is more so those alternatives affect more is the funding and cost side of things versus the enrollment side of things because of the location of where these choices exist for students within the state. They tend to be more focused in a suburban or urban area versus a rural area where there aren't as many alternatives.
Chris, thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Kemp, researcher at the UW-Madison Applied Population Laboratory. She says there's a perfect storm hitting many rural schools in Wisconsin, enrollment and funding going down along with it, costs not going down at the same time.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change to help these districts? If you live or work in a small town or a rural school district, tell us what's going on in your schools. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about schools in rural Wisconsin with Sarah Kemp from UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory.
And you can call in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the perfect storm in your school district? Declining enrollment, drops in funding, still high costs? And if you're in one of these small town or rural areas, how important is that local school to your community, its identity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. So do you see, Sarah, anything changing anytime soon? You said the enrollment numbers probably going down. There's nothing in on the horizon that seems like it's going to change anything at these rural schools.
At this point in time, I don't see any evidence of an increase in enrollment. As I mentioned earlier, the births have continued to decline, largely due to the recession. We saw the birth peak in the state in 2007, and then they've been declining ever since that time. So now, many years later, now those smaller birth cohorts are now moving to school age, and so population is likely to continue to decline in at least in the next 5 years.
Go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Dan on the line in Menominee. Dan, hi.
Hi. I'm a educator. In fact, I'm writing a chapter in a book on Wisconsin rural education right now. I taught in a number of the rural schools, Turtle Lake, Alma Center. And my perspective is we don't value rural schools. You know, your rural schools are unique. They have a unique perspective. And basically what's happening is because of the we don't want to fund them adequately, because they are costly, but they are unique. The rural life, you know, is unique. It, you know, but the way we want to educate kids is like, you know, other than take Turtle Lake, for example, a school that's decreasing in enrollment, but the way we want to fund it is basically we don't care whether it's Turtle Lake or whether it's La Crosse or Menominee. We just want to fund them just like every other district. And we're erasing the rural character, the rural life of kids.
And Dan, before I let you go, I wanted to ask, how important do you think that school, you know, say Turtle Lake or whatever small district, keeping that school, not having it consolidated with a wider district, do you see that as important to the character, the identity of that place?
It is. It is. You know, and we're forcing these schools to basically abandon their rural identity and just basically, you know, create a standardized identity. And that's terrible. You know, these schools are the identity of the community. And it's very important for them to keep that. And the people who attended those schools, you know, have a loyalty to them, but they're just so depressed by what's happening with their school districts.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. And Sarah, again, a bit beyond the scope of your research, I think, but one of the points Dan brought up was a kind of a cookie-cutter approach. We expect a rural school to do exactly the same thing as the suburban school or the urban school that may come with costs, too. And that's one of those costs, Sarah, that probably isn't going to go down.
Sure. Yes. If we think about how rural schools were back in the industrial turn of the century, two centuries ago, and we had all these one-room schoolhouses all dotting all over the country, and it was a very different place than we are now today. But there's definitely, over the time, as both state and federal assessments and standards that have been set, there has been that that way of doing education for many, many years. And so I think a lot of rural, especially individuals who study rural areas, are taking a step back and thinking about this picture as Dan just described, and that it's a very different picture in a rural area than it might be in an urban or suburban area.
Dan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Kemp. She's with UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She researches Wisconsin school districts, talking specifically about rural districts around the state, seeing declining enrollment, having a tough time meeting budgets in many cases because of that declining enrollment, and maybe having to face tough choices in some cases. Going back to your calls now with Paul in Waupaca. Paul, hi.
Yes, great conversation. I really appreciate this subject. It's just my question is why it takes so long, I guess, to understand some of the demographic changes. I appreciate the study, but it seems like we should be a little quicker to close down some of these schools, consolidate, cut some costs, especially in the administration side. I might be stating my age a little bit, but I know I went to a two-room school out in the country years ago, and that was closed down, and I went to a, you know, it was a small town yet. But we got consolidated. I'm 56 years old, I think we're just going through some of those same demographic changes now with less kids coming up behind the boomer generations. There's just not that many kids out there anymore, and I just encourage them to consolidate and cut some of that administration cost. You know, it's difficult to do, but I really think it's wise. It's what any small business would have to do.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Sarah, if people do agree that consolidation is the right option, this is probably not something that could happen overnight, is it?
Right. Well, and there is an argument Rob's argument is valid in that of these 55% of the districts within the state, only 19% of the student population is in over half our districts. So there's this push and pull that's just very challenging for all districts to make really hard choices.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Annie with us in Delton. Annie, hi. Try that again. Annie, there you are. Annie, hi.
Hi. I didn't get in on all of this program, so maybe this has been addressed, but I am currently attempting to send the third child through UW-Madison, and these kids are very bright young people, but they sure struggle and end up putting in extra years at school because rural districts are so poorly prepare these kids for college. And we're going to make more cuts, and it's going to be harder to do referendums to raise more money, and we're already behind the eight ball with these kids. My daughter had a choice of four advanced placement courses to kind of sharpen her skills before going to college, and she's meeting kids who've had 20 and 24 choices from urban areas.
Annie, we'll leave you with the last word, highlight some of the problems that this could all lead to. And Sarah Kemp, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
That's Sarah Kemp, researcher at the UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. A summary of her research on rural schools is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've crossed a new threshold in games and computer technology. For the first time ever, a computer program has mastered the ancient Chinese board game Go.
According to a paper published today in the journal Nature, the Google DeepMind program has beaten a number of other computer programs at the classic game, and it beat the European human champion 5-0.
Computers have already beaten the pants off human chess grandmasters. There's Deep Blue and Garry Kasparov, if you want to know more about that. But Go was actually seen as the next frontier.
I've played a little Go. I'm terrible at it. There have long been computer programs that can beat me at this game. I think random number generators could beat me. But a lot of people who knew the game said, nope, never going to happen. A computer can't do it. It's too complicated. There's as many permutations of the board as there are atoms in the universe or something
like
that.
And people need to stop saying it's never going to happen. Computers can't do it. Because whenever they say that, well, guess what?
Yeah. So, again, I've got to up my Go game now because the computers are even better than they were. I mean, again, children in the world could beat me at this game who have never looked at a Go. Have you ever played?
I've never played this, but I had to tell you.
It's a beautiful game.
It is a little worrisome, this news, because before long, they're going to have software that can host public radio shows, and then we won't even notice the transition.
I'm Veronica Rugert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network